Now stay tuned for the Sunday morning wake-up call on 94.7 WPVC LP Charlottesville. The wake-up call talks with the people in Charlottesville and Albemarle County who are making a difference. Now here's your host, Rick Moore.
And good morning, everyone. Sunday morning wake-up call. I'm Rick Moore. Today, a very interesting and unusual topic. We're going to talk about altered states of consciousness. Our guest, Dr. Kim Penberthy, she's a professor of psychiatry and neurobehavioral sciences at UVA School of Medicine, the Chester F. Carlson professor. Dr. Penberthy, welcome.
Thank you. I'm happy to be here.
And we're happy to have you as well, chatting by telephone. Thank you for participating in today's show. Altered states of consciousness. That's not a topic that I get to talk about very much. I'm curious as to how an academic professor gets involved in this topic. Can you tell me a little bit about your background?
Sure. I am a clinical psychologist, and I began my career in academics as actually a student in experimental psychology, studying learning in animals, and decided I liked working with people a lot better. So I went and got a PhD in clinical psychology. And I was always interested from a young age in altered states of consciousness and the impact on human behavior and human emotion. And started doing research on not just psychotherapy, which if you think about it can alter the way we behave and think and feel. I also started looking at interventions that included things like meditation and contemplative practices to help augment the psychotherapy. And I became very, very interested in those sort of techniques to literally change the way people think and feel and behave. And then beyond that, looking at other impacts that it has. And so that sort of landed me where I am right now.
And so now you're at UVA.
Yes.
And I think for a lot of people, they would be surprised that the University of Virginia does any work on altered states of consciousness. Is that where you're doing your work?
That's right.
So I don't want to get away from the topic, but I was fascinated. I'm fascinated. I'm a believer in some of the things that we're going to talk about, altered states of consciousness. It's going to be the majority of what we're going to talk about for the hour. You did a minor bit on transmediumship and some other things. So I don't want to get people believing that I'm going to give you a hard interview, like that's not true, that sort of thing. But but I think for many people, they'd be like, what, UVA? So I am curious as to the University of Virginia. People would be surprised, I think, that the University of Virginia has this sort of studying going on under its wing.
Well, it sounds like it might sound like some sort of far out type of thing. And yet, especially for the things that I do, I think once people hear what we're studying and the scientific methods that we're using, it doesn't seem as unusual. So, in fact, what's interesting, and many people might not know, is that the Division of Perceptual Studies has been around for 50 years. So not only are we doing this, we've been doing it, not me, but people for the past 50 years have been involved in this kind of research. And I think the thing that really makes it feasible and is really that it is so scientifically approached. And it's interesting you say that, you know, you are open to this. I think many people are open. And I think it's very important to not just be open, but to also remember we need to bring our scientific rigor to this area, of all areas, this area especially. So that is why I think it is so unique that this topic is being studied in a scientific community by scientists. And I think that is, you know, a really unique situation that's not happening everywhere in the world.
Again, our guest today is Dr. Kim Penberthy. You mentioned the Division of Perceptual Studies, and I'll get into that a little later into the hour. Your work that I want to spend a lot of the hour on is mediation and altered states of consciousness. Can you give us a sentence or two on what that is about?
Absolutely. Many people in your listening audience might be familiar with mindfulness or meditation or different kinds of yoga practices. This has become increasingly more mainstream and well-known, and at least in the United States and in many other countries, it's been around for a long time and practiced for years, decades, and centuries even. And so the research I am doing is really looking at what happens when people meditate and what changes happen in their brain, in their body, and what sort of outcomes they report. My research specifically focuses on different kinds of outcomes that I might be interested in, like depression or anxiety or self-compassion. And then also what's very interesting, and a lot of people don't know, is that the meditations or mindfulness practices not only impact those things like how you feel, they can also impact beyond that into both physiology, so maybe changing the way your brain patterns are working or changing biological functioning. It also is quite well known in some of the ancient texts. I mean, these have been going on for a long time, these sort of practices. Those ancient texts talk about other sort of supernormal abilities that can happen, like reducing what are called defiling impulses. This would be basically in our modern language saying reducing sort of addictive behaviors. And then there's other sort of impacts as well that we can talk about. But that's to sort of in a nutshell, what I do is really look at the practice of contemplative sort of interventions and the outcomes in people.
Well, when you talk about mediation, let's define that for some people. Because when I look at the word, my brain always wants to see meditation. But so what is mediation?
Well, so mediation in statistics and scientific sort of studies is saying that one factor impacts the other, if that makes sense. So when, for instance, in studies, I might have people meditate and then I look at whether mindfulness mediates the impact on something else. For instance, self-compassion. If you're more mindful, then that is sort of the component that helps increase self-compassion or reduce depression. So sometimes we know in research studies we're looking at complicated relationships between things. The mediators and there's are the way that we sort of help explain it.
All right. And so when you, I see that when you're looking at a report between mediators and non-mediators and what they report, so what are you studying about their reports? I mean, what are you asking them to report?
Well, those are meditators versus non-meditators. So those are people who are actively meditating in a structured way versus people who are not actively meditating. So I think that's what you're talking about in some of the research that we've been looking at, is really comparing people who've got no exposure to any kind of meditative practice. They're not practicing mindfulness. They're not doing yoga. And we would call them non-meditators. They're sort of your average person who's just not involved in that. And then what we've done is compare them to people who are actively enrolled in meditation courses, know how to do some sort of mindfulness meditation, and they're actively doing that. And that's one way. We have a study that we actually just completed where we looked at what are the differences between those people at the beginning of the time that we looked at and then at the end of the time that we looked at. So we let people meditate in a pretty intense way and studied them before and after and then compared them to people who did no meditation. And that's one of the studies that we're finishing up and just beginning to look at the results of.
Again, our guest today is Kim Penberthy. She's the professor at psychiatry and neurobehavioral sciences at UVA's School of Medicine. So meditators, I'm looking at all these notes here, and this is where I fumble across all the time. Mediators and meditators, so close for my brain to, I should have highlighted red versus green or something here. I have a note that says, meditators and the unusual experiences they report during and around a time of their meditation sessions. So what kind of reports or what kind of unusual experiences are we talking about?
Well, I want to back up first and talk about some of the experiences that people report that we think of as really positive, and these are things that have been studied and increasingly studied over the past decade more and more, where people are teaching even students in grade school how to meditate. Many of your listeners might have seen some of those reports. We did a study a couple of years ago and published it in 2016 looking at teaching just some sort of basics of meditation to college students at the University of Virginia. And what we found is this was a college course, just sort of like a survey course, where they learned a little bit about the history of the meditative practice, and then they got to practice it and learned about modern applications. And they just sort of kept track of what, you know, practicing and were encouraged to do that. And we asked them to fill out some questionnaires before and during the middle of the course and at the end of the course. Now, this was just one course for college students who had a lot of other things going on. They signed up just to take the course. But what we found is over time, we found significant improvement in their self-compassion. We saw a significant reduction in their anxiety levels and in their positive coping skills and in their mindfulness. So even though they didn't sign up to learn how to do this or to feel better, we saw these improvements, which are pretty remarkable and really positive for college students who might be stressed out. And so this was a really interesting thing that I saw. And to be quite honest, I was surprised by the effects. I didn't think we would really see any kind of effect. I mean, these are UVA students. They're very accomplished. They're very capable. This was a course they were signing up for just out of curiosity, not necessarily to, you know, it was never advertised as, you know, feel better about yourself and improve your coping. It was never advertised like that. It was just a course. And they improved, which was just amazing. So I think that's one of the baseline things we have to look at is that we do have increasing data to show that some sort of mindfulness or contemplative practice does seem to help improve your self compassion, which is that sort of those kinder thoughts towards yourself, and also reduce anxiety symptoms and improve coping. And I, you know, for some people that would be extraordinary. That would be amazing. We also see that there are impacts in even more extraordinary things that people report. And I think that's what we're typically talking about with the unusual experiences or the extraordinary experiences. And I can certainly discuss that with you.
Well, the class you're discussing didn't have anything to do with the person teaching it, didn't have anything to do with the time of year, anything like that?
Well, you bring up really good points because we did not replicate it. We have not gone back and tried it with, you know, a different set of teachers. There were two teachers. There were multiple lab instructors. The idea that one of them impacted would be sort of difficult to imagine. But you're right. The combination of those particular teachers or lab instructors might have helped people feel better. It's hard to imagine that, though, since, again, this was not a therapeutic intervention. It wasn't, therapy. It wasn't like someone sitting with them and talking about their problems or helping support them. It was just, you know, a regular course. But you're right. It definitely would need to be repeated with a lot of different variables changed to see what impact it might have. And indeed, I know at the University of Virginia, I can't speak extensively to this, but they are doing more and more research looking at, you know, using mindfulness practices in the classroom to help teachers with teaching more effectively, help students with regulating emotion and being more, you know, present. So that's sort of going a little bit off topic, but I think we will probably see more and more of this, you know, implemented into our classrooms.
Very interesting. Again, our guest today is Dr. Kim Penberthy, talking with us by telephone about altered states of consciousness. We are here today. Sorry, I lost my track because I was trying to pull up. What's the who's the endowed chair name?
Chester F. Carlson.
Chester F. Carlson has provided the chair where you are the professor of psychiatry and neurobehavioral sciences. So, Professor Kenberthy, you were going to tell us some of the things that you did find out from the mediators and their unusual experiences. So let's take our first break. When we come back, will you do that for us?
Absolutely.
All right. So we'll be right back with Professor Penberthy. Hang tight. And we're back here with Dr. Kenberthy. Altered states of consciousness is where we are today. Dr. Penberthy with us by phone here on the Sunday morning wake-up call. Dr. Penberthy was going to talk about some of the meditators and their unusual experiences that they report after their meditation sessions. Dr. Penberthy, I'm fascinated about some of their experiences. What can you share?
Sure. I started on a line of research in this area when I was working with patients with personality disorders and treating them with a therapy called dialectical behavior therapy, which has a mindfulness component that is taught to patients, and it really is a kind of meditative practice that is taught to them to sort of help center themselves. And what I noticed over several years of doing this clinically and working with patients was that they spontaneously were reporting things like the fact that they noticed an increase in some abilities to sort of predict things. Their intuitiveness seemed to increase. And I thought this was really interesting, so I started doing some research on it and found that this had been reported by other people as well. And it is one of those extraordinary experiences that is predicted in some of the Buddhist or yogic sort of traditions where meditative practices have been studied for a good bit of time. And they call these siddhis, which is spelled S-I-D-D-H-I-S. And these are sort of the extraordinary supernormal powers that were hypothesized to happen when people practice meditative, contemplative, or mindfulness sort of interventions in a regular way. And there are, you know, historical documents of people achieving pretty impressive sort of abilities to know the future or teleport themselves. Those are some of the more extraordinary ones. So I began looking at this and realized that mindfulness-based relapse prevention, which is a therapeutic intervention I use as well, was directed at reducing those appetitive drives by teaching people mindfulness skills. And that's, again, listed as one of these extraordinary abilities to reduce appetitive drives. And so this made me really interested in studying this more and finding out how often is this happening? How often are people who meditate or practice mindfulness or yoga reporting things like this? And so I started a line of research in that. And it's interesting because, you know, Rick, I mean, when we do research in mindfulness, and it's been increasing over the years, people typically don't ask these kind of questions. They don't ask, have you noticed that your intuitive powers have increased? Or have you noticed that you can see things and know things that other people can't? So we don't really know how often this is happening. And there were some colleagues who were beginning to look into this in California at the Institute of Noetic Sciences, and I joined up with them. They had done some research just sort of surveying people who were doing mindfulness practices or meditation retreats, and they found extraordinary numbers. I have them here in front of me, to the percentage of people reporting some sort of mystical or transcendent experience when they, you know, did one of these retreats or practiced meditation was almost 70%. Of the people endorsing this. So that's pretty remarkable. That's a lot of people practicing meditation. And we're not talking about people who became, you know, Tibetan monks or gurus or anything. These are just sort of normal people. So that was really pretty astounding.
That's a large number.
Yeah. Yeah. And so they looked, that group specifically, you know, published this and published the numbers in 2018, and also thought, well, there will be skeptical people who can't believe that this is true and will say, well, these are people meditating. Maybe there's something, you know, different or unique about those people who choose to meditate. So what they did is they did a big survey, and they said, you know, who could we survey who would be very, very skeptical, cynical, and, you know, we could compare our group of meditators to those folks. And so they surveyed engineers and scientists. They got big lists of people who were, you know, professionals with higher level degrees. And so they sent out a questionnaire for those folks asking, again, about extraordinary experiences, things like knowing things that they couldn't know, or being in touch with someone far away and knowing information from them that you wouldn't otherwise know, knowing something about the future, that sort of thing. And what they discovered is they compared it to what they called enthusiasts. So these were people who meditated, who were really into this, really, you know, bought into it. They compared it to a general population of just random people surveyed. And then they looked at specifically scientists and engineers. And for people who report one or more experience, some sort of extraordinary experience, and that's a sort of a broad way to sort of define this, you had 94% of the general population endorsing at least one or more experience. You had 99% of the enthusiast, which is not surprising. And then you had 93.2% of the scientists and engineers. So what this tells us is there's not that much difference. Most people, it seems, have had some sort of extraordinary experience where they've maybe been in touch with someone that they think was a deceased sort of person trying to get back in touch with them. Maybe you see a cardinal and you say, that's my mom. My mom told me she would come back as a cardinal and check on me. Or maybe you dreamt about something and then it happened. Those sorts of things, people report that these happened to them. And I thought that was just absolutely amazing because not too many people talk about this on a broad scale in society.
But are those things... I want to say, are those things... I'll just use the word. Are those things true things? I mean, when you talk about a cardinal in the yard, or are those things just stories that have come down through time that, oh, the cardinal is representative of this?
Right, right. That's exactly the question that we need to answer. And so that's why my colleagues at the Institute of Noetic Sciences and I put in a grant proposal to look at this in a more controlled way. Because you're right, those are all retrospective reports, and we don't have any evidence to really support that. So what we need is really more structured scientific research. So we got funding to do a study and look at people who signed up to do meditation through an intensive course. This is the one I referenced earlier. And we compared them to people who did not meditate, had no interest in it, and were not going to meditate. And we looked over a period of time. It varied depending on the length of the meditation retreat the person was in, but it was essentially an average of 2 weeks. And we assessed them before and after. And what we decided to do is, in addition to looking at self-report of did these things happen to you? Did you experience this? We also did tasks online that would help measure some of these abilities. So there are tasks formulated and exist now that can help measure things like, can you predict what object is going to display on the computer next? That sort of thing, which we would think of as, you know, presentience or an ability to sort of know what's going to come next. And so we did a series of those exams as well, thinking exactly like you did, that might be a more scientifically rigorous way of addressing this. Does that make sense?
It does. And, you know, I think everyone hopes that they're deceased parent or spouse has come back to make a statement to them or give them some sign of care, but it's something else to have had some sort of altered state of consciousness, to refer back to the title of today's show with Dr. Kim Penberthy, to actually leave your body and go somewhere else and learn something that there's no way that you would know. And
well,
that's
the thing that connects them is that both would be indicative that things don't operate quite the way we think right now, according to, you know, our paradigm right now. Both would indicate that there's something beyond just our brains in our body, if that makes sense. So that's how I see those things related. And the nice thing is I do see that there are methods we can use to look at it more rigorously, because you're absolutely right. Depending on people's reports and saying, yes, I saw mom returning in the form of a cardinal, that may be true for that individual, and yet it's hard to verify what that might mean, or that is indeed the cardinal that represents their mother. So those are very important emotionally to people, absolutely. And I'm sure, you know, anyone who's experienced that would endorse that. And at the same time, that's less able to be studied. And so we look at other ways of studying these extraordinary experiences where we can control it a little more. And I think that's what's so interesting, is that with the technology we have today, we have an increasing ability to look at assessing these skills in a more rigorous way.
Do you have any, when we talk about mediation, meditation, altered states of consciousness, do you have anything that relates to telepathy or clairvoyance or stories of past lives or anything like that?
Well, I can tell you what we found in this most recent study, which looked at, it compared people who had signed up to do meditation and they were in a retreat and involved in that. And then we compared it to people who were not meditating and had no interest. And we did give them these tasks online, as I said, and we were looking to see if one group versus the other would be able to perform, you know, more accurately on these sorts of measures. And so what we found is, was, you know, not extremely robust, to be completely honest. Part of it is that it's difficult to design studies to look at this. Like I said, you have to do things like studies that say predict, you know, the color of the next block that you see on the screen, and they're not ideal for measuring these extraordinary abilities, but we did the best we could. And what we saw was that there were only a few tasks where people meditating really did significantly better than what you might predict by chance. And the main one was a sort of a test of what we would call intuition. And what this is it presents a image of a jar filled with like marbles, and it is on the screen of the computer for a very, very short time. It's such a short time that you could not actually see it and register it, if that makes sense. And then like you couldn't possibly see it long enough to count all the marbles. And then we asked people to estimate the number of marbles in the jar. And what we found is that the meditators could do this better than the non-meditators. So people who had been practicing meditation intensely did this significantly better than average and significantly better than the people who had not been meditating. And that's an indication of intuition. The idea is that you are not using logic to sort of estimate the number. You're using an intuitive approach that is an extraordinary experience, an extraordinary ability, if you will. Interestingly, the other measures that we looked at, like being able to impact what happened on the screen, like move objects on the screen that were moving around, or predict the next color of a card. Those did not reach significance, and so we did not see those abilities improve on our measures.
Again, our guest today is Dr. Kim Penberthy. She's the Chester F. Carlson Professor of Psychiatry and Neurobehavioral Sciences at UVA School of Medicine. Dr. Penberthy, are these folks being studied? Have any of them been studied? Do you go looking for people who claim to be psychic?
We don't really go looking for them, no. Because, again, we're trying to do this in a more scientific approach where we set up more standardized type of studies, and then we would be intentionally sort of trying to get people that we could bring in and sort of control what they're exposed to. Certainly we have had people contact us and approach us, and I think that's always probably going to happen. But most of the time we're really trying to make sure we have people enrolled in studies, and we're doing this in a fairly scientific way so that we can rest assured of what we can sort of control what we can control to the best of our ability.
I was just wondering if there was ever the opportunity to tell somebody, hey, that person is psychic, or sorry, don't, you're not matching up to the test that we're doing.
We're not going to be doing that sort of thing, like validating someone's psychic ability or anything like that. No.
I want to get, as far as your test goes, and we're getting close to the next break. Why don't we do that now, so that we're not interrupted into the next question? I want to come back and I want to talk about how you help put people into their, correct? Don't you help put some folks into their consciousness? Trying to find my note on this, but don't you, let's take our break and I'll find my note. Our guest today, Dr. Kim Penberthy, Professor of Psychiatry and Neurobehavioral Sciences. We'll be right back. And we're back with Dr. Kim Penberthy talking about altered states of consciousness. Dr. Penberthy, I think when people think of altered states of consciousness, many people think of folks rising above their body on the hospital bed. Does that happen?
Okay, so you are talking about a specific sort of thing, like an out-of-body experience.
Sure, yes. There's the phrase.
Yes, which is one way we can think of an altered state of consciousness. So I think it might be really positive for listeners to conceptualize altered states of consciousness much more broadly and think about that there are many ways, if we think of our consciousness, which is sort of ourselves, our being, to expand that or change that. You can do that through prayer. You can do that through sort of rhythmic motion. You can do that through psychedelic drugs. And then you can do it through meditation or mindfulness. Now, some people experience out-of-body experiences when they have a near-death experience. For example, my colleague Bruce Grayson studies near-death experiences, and often people do experience feeling that they're out of their bodies, and they can report things that happened that they wouldn't otherwise have known. There are other kinds of experiences that can happen when you meditate. You can have an out-of-body experience from meditating. We have many people in our studies who endorse that. And, of course, there are people on psychedelic drugs who report out-of-body experiences. There are people who have very spiritual or mystic sort of experiences and might report out-of-body experiences as well. So that's just sort of one way of thinking about it. As I said earlier, this altered consciousness can also be something as straightforward as changing the way you feel about yourself and being more compassionate to yourself. Or it can be in the form of reducing that appetitive drive, so not needing that addictive substance anymore, and being able to be present without that burning desire or craving in you. So when I talk about altered states, it's really that broad continuum. For instance, I am trying to gear up for another study looking at helping people who have, you know, the crippling fear of death and dying. And this is not an insignificant part of the population. Especially, I work with a lot of medical patients, people who have serious diseases, and they often have very intense fear of death and dying. And we're looking at ways of what you might say altering people's consciousness in order to help them reduce that fear or come to terms with that. And so that would include mindfulness-based interventions to help people, again, change that state of consciousness and be more comfortable or overcome that fear of death and dying.
Dr. Penberthy, you talk about your study on fear of death and dying. 65%, is that the number you gave me on people who have this fear? Well,
yeah, it's very high.
If 65% have the fear, I would have assumed that more people have the number. Who doesn't have the number? I mean, 35% don't have the number. Who are those folks?
Well, you have to remember that data was from a group of people with severe medical conditions. So these are people who really have this on their mind because of their health. So that's not a number from the whole population. If that was from the whole population, I think we would have some significant problems, number one, but we would also have some really effective treatments by now. So, no, those numbers are from people struggling with really serious illnesses. I think that helps make sense of it a little more.
Okay. Can you talk a little bit more about that study, the fear of death and dying study?
Well, we don't have it yet. What we did is we started with a survey because we had an interest in this. And so we did that survey that you referred to, looking at asking people, you know, who have severe medical problems, very serious illnesses. We did a survey online of those folks and asked them about their fear of death and dying, and that's where we got that number. And then we also asked them about what kind of treatments or interventions they would find acceptable, because we could go ahead and develop a study and plan, you know, a treatment. However, if nobody is interested in doing it or nobody thinks it would be helpful, then it will be hard to recruit people to participate. So we thought we'll start at the beginning and we'll find out how prevalent is this and what would people be willing to do. And so what we found is we asked them if they would be willing to do a treatment like a mindfulness-based treatment, if they would be willing to do psychotherapy. There are psychotherapies that do things like a life review to help people address their fear of death and dying. And then we asked them if they would do things like a virtual out-of-body experience that we could do through virtual reality, or if they would if they would be willing to do something like a psychotropic medicine like psilocybin to gain that sort of euphoric experience from that. And we're just finishing up the analysis of that and going to be trying to publish it. What we found is that most people endorsed the mindfulness-based approach as something that they thought would be acceptable, and so that they would try it, and that they thought it would be helpful. And so I thought that was fairly interesting. The good news is there weren't any real strong negative reactions to any of the interventions.
Are these studies done, do they include the family members in any way, or just the individuals? Or do you think the family members are involved in any way?
That's a really, really insightful question. Our survey that we did, that's the only research we've done to date, and that did not include information from the family members. I think your point is a good one, that in that that needs to be incorporated in the future. We did a pilot study, this was a few years ago, looking at a mindfulness-based intervention for people living with lupus. If you know what that is, it's an autoimmune disorder. It can be very debilitating, very serious. And we did the intervention with patients who had lupus and with a loved one. So this was their support person that they brought with them. And I think that that is going to be increasingly important to remember to include the other people in these folks' lives, because they're very significantly impacted. And your point is well taken, that that would be important to include in the future.
Yeah, my minimal experience has been that the person in the hospital bed has become a little more accepting than the family members around. So I would be curious as to what percentage who have the fear, the 35% who haven't, who are no longer afraid, might be a higher percentage. It's just, again, mm-hmm. Our altered states of consciousness conversation with Dr. Kim Penberthy. He's the Chester F. Carlson Professor of Psychiatry and Neurobehavioral Sciences at UVA's School of Medicine. Professor, can I ask a question or two about some other work that you've done?
Sure.
Not as heavily involved, but a foot in the water on a couple of these other tests, studies. The trance mediumship, can you tell us, give us a definition of that?
Well, this is a study that I'm only peripherally knowledgeable about, so I'm not going to be very well equipped to address this. These are, though, if you think of mediums, they're often what people call psychics, and those folks, we typically think about them having an altered state of consciousness when they are doing the work that they claim to do. So when they are accessing information, they seem to be in, you know, at least in report, some sort of altered state of consciousness, which is, you know, interesting in that realm of research to think about, well, what is happening to them? And certainly many of them, you know, if you believe their claims, they are accessing information that they couldn't otherwise access, which would be similar to what we were just talking about with, you know, the meditators and people who endorse these extraordinary abilities after you know, meditating and being able to achieve these altered states of consciousness. So that's sort of how we would conceptualize it. And then, you know, looking at that in multiple ways, including examining their brain function as they do what they say they're doing. And this, again, is very much increasing in popularity across the globe of looking at people in these altered states of consciousness while we're measuring what's happening in their head. So looking at them in the functional neuroimaging, so what we call fMRIs, many of your listeners might be familiar with that, or looking at them with EEG leads. Again, people are familiar with that. So looking at actually what's happening in the brain as people are in these altered states of consciousness has become increasingly common, where people are trying to see what do we think is happening? What exactly is going on in the brain? And we are beginning to see some interesting data there. So I think, you know, that's a natural type of thing to do, to say not only how does this impact the person with their mood and their behavior, and but what's actually happening to them physically.
There's also a study on mindfulness-based relapse prevention.
Right. So that study has been completed, and what we did is, again, looked at developing this contemplative intervention, so an intervention to help alter the state of consciousness for folks, and this was geared towards people with addiction, and looking at the impact of learning a mindfulness-based approach or a way to address their cravings. And what we found, which was similar to other published research, again, around the country, is that it does seem to help people reduce their appetitive drive, their reduction in addictive behaviors. So we had one looking at people with alcohol dependence, and then another looking at smoking. And the idea is that the meditative approach, that contemplative practice, does change your consciousness, so that not so much that you don't have cravings anymore, it's that it's almost like it's that you're just not bothered by them as much or anymore. So it's a really interesting approach. It's a different state of being with those cravings, if you will, which is really fascinating.
And so where do you go next? What are the next steps that still need to be taken in your altered states of consciousness, your mediation, meditation, altered states of consciousness study?
Oh, there's so much to do, Rick. There's so much. It's really exciting. So I think one area is looking more at the changes in the brain. And you know, right now what's so exciting is that some of the data is showing really interesting things there. You know, many people thought, well, if meditators, people who are doing contemplative practice, have these abilities, and maybe it's because their brain is, you know, working on overdrive, and we'll see their brains, you know, firing off all kinds of things. And it's actually not what you see in a lot of the data coming out. What seems to be emerging potentially, and we need more research, is this idea that maybe what is actually happening is the brain is quieting down. It's almost like the brain is getting out of the way so you can access these abilities. And then that has led some people to think, well, then potentially, you know, everyone could have access to these abilities, or at least some level of it. It might be another characteristic like musical ability, where you might have a little or a lot of it, and yet everyone has access to it. So we do know people can actively practice meditating and get better at it and gain access to some of these really positive effects. So we are moving forward. We have funding to do another research project, and this will probably be starting in a few months, maybe the spring, where we will take it to the next step of scientific rigor by recruiting people to participate and then assigning them to either a control group where they do not meditate, they don't have any exposure to it, or a group where we do some intensive meditation and then look at changes over time. And that's because, if you remember what I said, the research we've done already really looked at what we call naturalistic groups, groups of people that already were meditating and wanted to take a retreat versus people who never meditated, weren't interested. And what we find is those two types of people are already different in their abilities. In that research, we did show the people who were in the meditation group already at the beginning started off reporting more extraordinary experiences and reporting, you know, more mindfulness, more self-compassion. So there's something different about those people already. And we need to figure out, is that because they've been meditating or is it because of something else? So the only way to show that is to take people and who have not had any exposure and then randomly assign them to become meditators or non-meditators. And that's our next project that we'll be doing.
Again, our guest today, Dr. Kim Penberthy. She's the Chester F. Carlson Professor of Psychiatry, Neurobehavioral Sciences at UVA School of Medicine. Dr. Penberthy, thank you so much. Fascinating conversation today. And I wish you luck. Hopefully you can come back on in the future and tell us how things are going and update us a little further.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you. Have a great day.
You too. I really appreciate it.
All right. Take care.
This has been the Sunday Morning Wake-Up Call on 94.7 WPVC-LP, the progressive voice of Charlottesville. Engineering assistance was by Mike Friend. The Wake-Up Call is produced by Dan Gould. Show archives can be found at cvillepodcast.com. Be sure to join Rick next Sunday morning at 11 a.m. for the Wake-Up Call, only on WPVC-LP Charlottesville.